As Russia continues its assault on Ukraine, calls for action from the international community grow louder, with debate raging on everything from the effectiveness of sanctions to whether NATO's involvement with Ukraine contributed to tensions with Moscow, and fears that direct action by NATO could translate into war across Europe. But can anything deter Putin? And what would a long war mean, not just for the people of Ukraine, but for Russian citizens as well? That's our discussion this week on an Upfront Special. Joining me to discuss the latest on Ukraine are Dr. Stephanie Babst, former Deputy Assistant Secretary General of NATO, Dr. Yevgenia Albats, Editor-in-Chief of Russia's The New Times magazine, and Dr. Agnia Grigas, a Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of the book Beyond Crimea, The New Russian Empire. Thank you all for joining me. Yevgenia, let me start with you. You've covered the Kremlin for decades, so you understand better than most people how they make decisions. We've seen weeks of warnings from the West about an imminent invasion of Ukraine, troop buildup along the border, and, of course, diplomatic efforts to avoid the outcome that we're seeing today. In your view, was war inevitable?
You know, obviously, I'm not in the business of reading the crystal ball. I'm just a journalist. But I do think that Putin made his mind pretty much last autumn. And when he realized that he was unable to force the West, the collective West, to provide him with the kind of world international arrangements that he wanted, it is to say that he wanted to divide the world into spheres of influence, and assigned to Russia all the former Soviet Republic. When he realized that he was not going to do that, he decided to start the war.
He seemed to be following the advice of very particular sets of advisors, particularly the most hawkish wing of his Security Council.
He doesn't have to follow advisors of any hawkish members of his Security Council, because he himself, a hardline politician with distrust of the West, he's a graduate of the Soviet Union's most repressive institution, the KGB, and these are the kind of institution which institutional culture and organizational culture always has been based on violence. So I would say that for Putin, it's just natural. If he couldn't get what he wanted to get, he waited, and then he decided to get it by force. You know, he wants to have the kind of order, the kind of international order that Stalin agreed to have with Roosevelt and Churchill. That's what he wants. And he wants to feel himself as a nowadays Stalin.
Stephanie, in recent months, Russia has repeatedly pointed the finger at NATO. Some have even argued that NATO is at least partially responsible for the outbreak of war, arguing that its expansion in the early 2000s to include former Soviet countries is at the root of today's crisis. Would you agree with that assessment?
No, unsurprisingly, I don't agree with that assessment. Let me say, first of all, I mean, that we do have principles, global principles, including the free choice of countries to determine their own security arrangements. NATO didn't go around shopping and ask people to join. It was vice versa. Countries like Lithuania, Estonia, the Czech Republic, Poland, all these countries really sought to become member of NATO because they thought it was best for their own countries, and they took a free and a liberal choice. That's number one. But number two, I would like to stress, I also recall vividly, because back then I was there, when we signed the strategic partnership with Russia. That was back in 1997. And we established a joint permanent council. So we gave Russia really quite a bit of say, if I can say so, on NATO issues. And we invited Russia to work with us jointly. And over almost 15 years, we worked with Russia. It's now almost unthinkable, I mean, to recall, but I was there. I was part of it. And I still vividly recall the many, many issues on which we work with Russia. And NATO has never done anything wrong in terms of suggesting to Russia that we would reduce their or ignore their legitimate concerns. By contrast, we invited them to be with us, to be partner with us.
Stephanie, there are some people who would say, I agree with everything you're saying, but in the absence of NATO, Putin doesn't have the pretext, that there would not have been an invasion absent the pretext of NATO and his concerns around NATO. What do you make of that?
Well, I suggest it's all part of Putin's narrative. He tried very hard and still is trying, I mean, to basically roll back history and interpret everything which I'm talking about, the past 20 years, as something which ultimately constitutes a threat towards Russia. So this is very much a narrative. And reactions in allied countries, basically, reactions around the world now make very clear that we don't buy into this narrative. We don't want to live in a world which is divided by spheres of influences. And we don't want to go back, as Yevgenia has said, to a Yalta-style power play, I mean, between the big powers. So I'm afraid to say Putin has miscalculated a lot.
Agnea, given that in his speech announcing the offensive into Ukraine, Putin also said the operation aimed to denazify the country. In your view, is the invasion, again, really about NATO, or is NATO just a pretext?
You know, NATO is absolutely just a pretext. There are many other pretexts that Putin has used. I mean, again, denazification, I mean, extraordinary statement. Completely detached from reality. President Zelensky himself is Jewish, so it's very difficult to make that argument. I mean, Putin has made other arguments that Ukraine is a brotherly nation, a brotherly Slavic nation, so therefore they're going to, you know, invade it, whether Ukraine likes it or not, to support and help their brotherly nation. So I think there are many narratives that Putin has tried playing out over the course of this time, and really since 2014, since the first invasion of Crimea, since the creation of separatist regions in Luhansk and Donetsk, at the time the pretext was that the Russian language speakers in Ukraine were being discriminated against, so therefore he's going to go in and help them. There's been many pretexts, but at the end of the day, I think this is really for him a project of personal ambition to try to reestablish Russia's influence and control over the post-Soviet space. President Putin has stated many times that the fall of the Soviet Union was the greatest catastrophe, geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. So this is, I think, something he wants to reverse and have this as his legacy as president of Russia.
Evgenia, NATO was formed in 1949 during the Cold War, primarily to counter potential Soviet threats. Does the organization's very existence still hinge upon a certain kind of tension or the threat of war from Russia?
When Putin became the president back in 2000, one of his first moves was he said that he would like to join, he would like Russia to join NATO. So at the very beginning of his presidency, there was no talk about any threat from the side of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. No, it's all pretext. Putin believes that Russia and, you know, he as a Russian Tsar has the right to decide which nation has full rights of sovereignty and which nation don't. So he decided that Ukraine doesn't have doesn't have this sovereign right to decide who to ally with, and that's it. I think that it's so misleading to keep talking about NATO threat. Look, the Russian propaganda machine no longer talks about NATO. Russian propaganda machine now tells to Russian citizens that Russia had to start this preemptive war in order to prevent Ukraine from developing its own nuclear weapon.
Stephanie, the war has put the question of NATO membership for Ukraine into conversation once again. It's on the table once more, despite having been repeatedly dismissed in the past. Why has the idea of Ukraine as a NATO member always seemed so unlikely?
Well, a bit like the European Union, NATO has an acquis for new members. So it is not just, I mean, that we look at photos, pictures, and listen to nice speeches. We want to make sure, NATO wants to make sure, that any new country accessing NATO can actually make a contribution, can bring to the table net military capabilities, shares the same values, doesn't have any type of territorial or other related conflict. I'm afraid to say it never actually met the criteria. There was still quite some work to do for the Ukrainians on their side. So that's more or less, I mean, the procedural aspect. But above all, there is a political aspect. And if there is one thing that I criticize when looking at my former employer, I think the decision taken back at the Bucharest summit in 2008 was not helpful because it left Georgia and Ukraine with this ambiguity. It was agreed, because there was no agreement, that we would invite Ukraine as well as Georgia to become member at some point, but we didn't specify a date. And that left the two countries in limbo. I thought, strategically speaking, politically speaking, that was not helpful neither for NATO's cause nor for the cause of the two countries concerned.
Agnew, another thing that creates difficulty is this question of energy independence. Right now, Europe plans to reduce its dependence on Russia, and that is perceived by Moscow as a threat. You yourself have called for more sanctions on Russia's Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the natural gas pipeline that would double Russia's natural gas exports to Europe via Germany. In your view, has Europe's energy dependence on Russia emboldened Putin?
Absolutely. And I think this energy dependence also was one of the reasons Putin miscalculated with this invasion. But if you look at Europe today, the reality is it's at least about a third dependent on Russian gas imports. Fortunately, with the globalization of the gas markets and the United States becoming a major gas producer and LNG exporter, there are more options for European importing states. But nonetheless, today they remain highly dependent. And Nord Stream 2 is a pipeline that had a big impact on the way this crisis unfolded, because the Nord Stream 2 pipeline directly from Russia to Germany, once it was completed, and completed today, it's not certified and not operational, and hopefully it won't become so. But once it was completed, it allowed Russia to bypass the Ukrainian gas pipeline system, which was one of the primary means of sending gas from Russia to Europe. And now that there's an alternative route, there was essentially this created a green light for Putin's government to invade Ukraine and to damage that pipeline in the process. If, you know, there was nothing holding it back from outright war and damaging that pipeline system, because there was a belief that now they'll have an alternative pipeline system. So this gas dependence, oil dependence, really has a direct links with this current war in Ukraine.
Let's talk a bit about sanctions. Evgenia, there's been a lot of debate over the impact of sanctions on Russia. Many have expressed concern that the effects of sanctions are more likely to be felt by ordinary Russian citizens rather than by the powerful, by the state itself. Are sanctions the right choice?
I'm not sure that I want to answer this question, because as a political scientist, I would say yes. I think that these harsh sanctions are going to create some pressure with Kremlin and over Putin, and may lead to the split of the elite and change of the regime. However, the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia, they affect a lot of my fellow citizens. We just yesterday, maybe before yesterday, we woke up in a totally new world, in a totally new country, and it doesn't look nice. In fact, you know, life looks ugly. A lot of private banks are insolvent now. People are trying to withdraw hard currency, dollars and euros, and they are meeting difficulties doing this. They're already not clear how Russians are going to, where Russians are going to buy their cars, or how they're going to conduct maintenance of their automobiles. There are a hell of a lot of problems that we're going to face pretty soon. However, I hate to talk about that because I feel so ashamed about what my country is doing right now to the neighboring country, to Ukraine. I see pictures from the web, and I know that hundreds and thousands of Ukrainians are dying each day, or they get wounded. The beautiful city. I traveled around Ukraine time and again. I know this country pretty well. I love it, this country. In fact, my grandma's family was from Ukraine. And I see what Russian missiles and Russian bombs are doing to Kharkiv, to Kiev, to Zhytomyr, to Mariupol. And I'm terrified that this is done by the army, which I, as a taxpayer, as a citizen of the Russian Federation, I pay for this. And that makes me sick, ashamed, and no sanctions are good enough if Putin and his people are not going to be punished for the kind of stuff that they did to, that they have been doing to Ukraine and to Europe in general. Listen, we in Europe, we found ourselves in 1939, that was the year when the World War II started. I couldn't believe that I live in the country which lost 27 million people to the World War II. And this very country where each piece of land is somebody's grave. This country started to war and killing people right now. 21st century Europe, it's just impossible to comprehend.
Stephanie, earlier this week, Switzerland announced that it would freeze Russian-held financial assets in the country, totaling more than $11 billion. It's a big number. That's according to the New York Times. That's a rather shocking move given Switzerland's long history of neutrality. What does that kind of move tell us?
It tells me that the global community is really rallying around one point, which is to really express their opposition, their frustration, their anger, their outburst with regard to what's ongoing in Ukraine. Even smaller countries, neutral countries like Switzerland, you mentioned, have joined the chorus. I must admit, I feel a little bit ambivalent about it. On one hand, I think it's absolutely good and important that the international community comes together from various sectors, countries, tech sectors, sports, cultures, you name it, to express their opposition. But the more we do it, the more I fear, I mean, we corner President Putin considerably. And if we were to put ourselves into his shoes and consider policy options, what is it, I mean, that can actually, how can move forward? What is his exit strategy? I feel, I mean, that we ourselves need to also get smarter and develop a strategy how to actually manage such a Putin regime under global pressure. I think that's the question which is on the table now for policymakers across the board. How do we manage that?
Agnea, I'm thinking about what Evgenia says about the kind of enormity of the moment she's making comparisons to 1939. The push that Stephanie's talking about from the global community is part of the response to this moment. What do you see as the proper global response, the proper type of pressure? Switzerland gives one model of it, but what do you see as the kind of broader response that you would expect from the global community?
Well, one specific thing I would like to see, particularly in Europe, is, and it's going to be difficult, I understand, but it's a move that Europe will have to make at some point. It's essentially sanctioning Russian sources of energy, Russian oil and gas. It's, again, not easy to achieve because Europe is dependent on this, but there are global markets. They may have to pay more. But if you look at it today, essentially the money that Europe spends or sends to Russia for oil and gas imports, this is essentially the Russian military budget. So if you want to cut off the Russian military budget, one of the primary things you could do is really start to get serious and start sanctioning Russian oil and gas. I think first with stopping the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, even stopping the operations of Nord Stream 1 pipeline. And I think Germany in this last week has really had an epiphany. They've really started re-examining their policies. Germany is Europe's largest gas market, largest client of Gazprom. So the moves they make will have a big difference. And I'm also seeing changes in Turkey as well. Turkey is the second largest market for Gazprom within the European context. And with the decision of President Erdogan to close the Bosphorus Straits to Russian military ship movement is a step in the positive direction.
Evgenia, we've seen thousands of Russians marching in anti-war protests. We've even seen some unexpected high-profile figures inside of Russia speaking out against the war. Is there any dissent, in your view, within Putin's inner circle or even within his government for what's happening right now?
I have no doubt that there are people who are strongly opposed to the war, especially those on the economic, on the financial side of the Russian government, because basically the Russian economy will be in pieces in a matter of several months. So the situation is extremely difficult. And, Russian hard currency reserves frozen, so central bank is unable to interfere. Therefore, Russian currency lost 30% of its value. It means that prices for all goods, food, or whatever commodities will go significantly up, and those who were poor will become much, much poorer. Russian young people, they are leaving the country en masse. They're just running outside the country. Russian rich people, Russian middle class, they're also, or everybody is trying to find way to get out of Russia. 6,000 people were detained as they took part in different protests across the country. My publication, The New Times, got blocked because Russian government believes that we shouldn't use the word war, or there are no war, no invasion, no offensive operation. It's just some operation that Putin conducts against a neighboring country. The only independent radio station left, Echo Moskvy, also was taken down by the Russian government. The only independent TV channel, TV Rain, was taken down by the Russian government as well. Its editor-in-chief and the majority of reporters decided to leave the country. I mean, it is a real disaster for my country.
Indeed. And we'll continue to cover this every step of the way. Stephanie, Evgenia, Agnia, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you.
That's our show. Upfront, we'll be back next week.